This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of Taking Aim. I'm Steve Woodward, and I wish I could tell you that seated across from me was David Hensley, but he is away this week, a little under the weather. I will try to go it alone and give it my best in his absence. It won't be the same, but he'll be back next week, and we'll keep doing this until everybody gets tired of us, which won't be anytime soon, I'm sure. Well, we've got a lot to talk about, as usual, because you know, the Democrats and the corrupt media continue to give us unlimited material, a bottomless well of hypocrisy, deception, and corruption, which is what we are taking aim on today. We begin, of course, with our first segment every week. We'll be identifying our public enemy number one. This week's dubious distinction goes to the newly elected and inaugurated Attorney General of North Carolina, it pains me to say it, Democrat Jeff Jackson. Now, he got all upset along with a bunch of other Democrat attorneys general when the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, as they're calling it, led by Elon Musk and a growing staff of lieutenants, DOGE went in and said, you know, hello, Treasury Department. You control all the outflows, all the spending, all the funding, and we don't really know very much about the transparency associated with that. We'd like to take a closer look. And boy, heads exploded at the thought that the President of the United States could direct his hand-selected people to go into the Treasury Department and take a look around, kick the tires, and see what in the heck's going on as we face a $36 trillion debt bomb that's only growing with each passing month and year. But the thing about Jeff Jackson is he's not really that good at explaining why his hair's on fire. Play clip four.
The premise of the lawsuit is that the law was broken, not just that we may have disagreed with this personally or from a policy standpoint, but that actual specific federal laws were broken. There are federal laws about how privacy is protected with this kind of data, and then there are laws about the process for changing these kinds of rules. We believe both of those sets of laws were broken.
Who did that remind you of? I was thinking immediately of Kamala Harris. You know, he just kept kind of talking and in vague generalities. And what he was overlooking deliberately, of course, is that there was no intention to go in and expose the identities of American citizens. The purpose of doing a forensic audit of the Treasury Department is to find out where all of our hard-earned taxpayer dollars are actually going. And very often, all we know is that they go into an endless black hole of entitlements and automatic payments. And this is the kind of thing that has been going on for so long that for the Democrats anyway, the thought of tightening the belt even slightly in certain areas is more than they can bear. And then it gets worse. So not only does Jackson participate in that lawsuit, then he joined another 21 states in filing a lawsuit trying to prevent funding cuts at the National Institutes of Health. They announced, the NIH announced, that it was going to cap administrative costs that it would cover, in other words, to reimburse research institutions, mostly universities, at 15%. Last year, of the $45 billion that was doled out by NIH on more than 50,000 grants, this was in fiscal year 23, of that $45 billion, $9 billion went to indirect costs, you know, overhead costs. And at some point, a lot of these universities with massive multi-million, billion-dollar endowments, you know, maybe they can pay some of their own overhead costs when they're conducting research. This is the logic of the NIH trying to save $9 billion, cut into the $9 billion that it annually forks out for non-research costs. Think about that. But Jeff Jackson, our attorney general, he wants to keep spending just like drunken sailors, like we always have. And he didn't stop there. He then joined another lawsuit to challenge Donald Trump's executive order, calling for the elimination of birthright citizenship in the United States. Again, this is another example of an attorney general trying to derail a perfectly legal and appropriate executive order issued by a sitting president. This litigation, he calls a response to a straightforward violation of the 14th Amendment. Of course, legal scholars will tell you that a closer reading of the 14th Amendment indicates that there has never been a provision for birthright citizenship in the way that it has been interpreted, whereby if you are born on U.S. soil to parents of immigrants, you're automatically a citizen. What they have conveniently overlooked is that oftentimes the parents are here illegally. So why should the children of illegal immigrants become instant U.S. citizens? And in fact, the real core problem there is that this is the incentive, the motivation for illegal immigrants to come to our country in the first place, so that they can have a lot of children and create instant U.S. citizens. The Constitution leaves no room for executive reinterpretation of this matter, Jackson claims, our Attorney General, Jeff Jackson. I think he's wrong, and I think that that time will tell that this thing's not going to hold up upon closer legal scrutiny. It bears noting also which Attorney General lawsuit he did not participate in. He did not join our public enemy number one. 16 states pledging to pursue criminal charges against Dr. Anthony Fauci. Now, you will recall that on his way out the door, Joe Biden, then president, maybe, of the United States, issued a pardon to Fauci, a preemptive pardon, because there are attorneys and organizations and American citizens who believe that Anthony Fauci, by conducting unauthorized gain-of-function research, was one of the people largely responsible for the unleashing of the Wuhan bioweapon known as COVID-19 in early 2020, if not sooner. But now we have attorneys general in 16 states saying, hold on just a minute. That was a pardon issued by a president at the federal level. Let's see what we can do at the state level. And we'll talk about that later on in the show in more detail. Now, of course, I had to remind you that we always have a close second for public enemy number one of the week. And this week's very close second, limping along, trying to get to the finish line, but failing, was Republican Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. You know, Mitch falls down a lot, but it never fails that he does not stumble when he has a chance to vote against Trump cabinet nominees. Specifically this week, he was a no vote on Pete Hegseth for Secretary of Defense, and a no vote a couple of days later on Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence. And when he's not voting no against Trump's appointees, he's fallen down a lot, and they're now taking him in and out of the Capitol in a wheelchair. It's a great look for 82-year-old Mitch McConnell, who has overstayed his welcome, as so many of them do. in the swamp. How about the stories that you might have missed in the past week? There are so many of them with the return of Donald Trump to the White House, so much happening that even those of us who go out of our way to keep up tend to fall behind. We have to feverishly monitor what is essentially a 24/7 news cycle. And but we're here to do it for you. That's why we're here. So what did you miss this week? Well, I think one of the big ones can be summed up very concisely. Fort Bragg is back. Play clip three.
Bragg is back. It means the legacy of an institution that generations of Americans have mobilized through and served at is back. I mean, it's a shame what was done to vets, service members, their families, who were born there, deployed out of there, lived there, gave their, I mean, was with airborne troops here, some of which spent 25 years at Fort Bragg. I never called it Fort Liberty because it wasn't Fort Liberty, it's Fort Bragg. And so I was honored to be able to put my signature on that. By the way, with the support of the President of the United States, who set the tone on this and said, I want Fort Bragg back. And we're honored to support a private first class who received a Purple Heart and the Silver Star at the Battle of the Bulge. You know, we're honoring a private first class, and I'm proud that we have a Marine Corporal as the Vice President of the United States, too. Junior enlisted have never seen better days. But it's about that legacy. It's about the connection to the community, to those who've served. And we're not, as the President has said, and I've said as well, we're not done there. There are other bases that have been renamed that erodes that very same legacy. There's a reason I said Bragg and Benning when I walked into the Pentagon on day one, but it's not just Bragg and Benning. There are a lot of other service members that have connections, and we're going to do our best to restore it. It's an honor to do so.
How about that? Fort Bragg is back, the largest Army base, I guess, in the world. And what's interesting to note, and why he prioritized Bragg as the first one to have its name restored from Fort Liberty, you know, think about, just say that a couple of times, Fort Liberty. What does it sound like to you? Very generic, right? A generic name. Of the other bases that were renamed, and there were 2, 4, 6, 8 of them under the Biden regime, all of those bases, unlike Bragg, were renamed to honor other people, not generically. That was, all of these were renamed. Fort Pickett in Virginia, Fort Rucker in Alabama, Fort Moore in Georgia, which used to be Fort Benning, quite a well-known base, Fort Eisenhower in Georgia, Fort Walker in Virginia, Fort Cavazos in Texas. One of them got a hyphenated name, just what the military needs is a hyphenated name. Fort Gregg hyphen Adams in Virginia, two guys. And Fort Johnson in Louisiana. But thankfully, that little chapter for Fort Bragg has been ended. And by the way, Pete Hegseth signed that order on his while airborne on en route on his first overseas trip as Secretary of Defense. When he landed, when he hit the ground in Germany, one of the first things he did was get together with a bunch of our soldiers stationed over there and join them in a very rigorous workout. You may have seen the visuals of him. There was weightlifting, there was running, and of course, it's nice to see a Secretary of Defense who can do all those things. Lloyd Austin, half the time, couldn't show up for work because he was, you know, in ill health. And you'll recall the pathetic images of him during the virus addressing troops in a faraway land wearing both a surgical mask and one of those stupid plastic shields over his face. Not one of the worst optics ever for the strength of the U.S. military abroad, but he, like so many others, are now just distant memories, distant memories. Here's another distant memory, although I'm not sure he's going to go away completely. Remember Roy Cooper? He was governor of North Carolina for 8 years. It seemed like about 18 years, didn't it? He enjoyed being the governor very much during the COVID pandemic, when he was gleefully issuing stay-at-home orders and then extending them and then keeping schools closed, even as children were falling behind in their classwork, in their learning, and more importantly, struggling mentally with the extended periods of isolation away from their friends and classmates. He was, even into the summer of 2021, you'll recall, Cooper was urging more shots in arms, more of the COVID jabs, the untrialed experimental serums, which we have now learned have many adverse effects, especially on young people. So what's Cooper doing now? Well, some have said he's going to run for Senate in 26 against Tom Tillis, the incumbent Republican. But in the as a backdrop of all the things he did during COVID, which were so detrimental to our state, he's now heading to Harvard, of all places, to undergo a or to participate in an 8-week teaching stint as a fellow in a prestigious school, the T.H. Chan School. You'll never guess what course he's going to teach. The intersection of government and public health. Now think about that. When he was the governor of North Carolina, that intersection was a raging dumpster fire of burned out vehicles that had all collided in that intersection as he wreaked havoc on everyday life, on businesses. Remember when he insisted that bars remain closed even when restaurants were open? Remember that? And he determined at one point that the virus only became dangerous after 11 p.m. So when the bars were reopened, they had to close at 11 because that's when the virus got, you know, kind of nasty, right at 11:01. Anyway, only Harvard would honor a man who did all of those things. And now I guess he thinks he's going to run for Senate. That'll be interesting. Unfortunately, Tom Tillis is probably a pretty vulnerable target for a motivated and very well-funded Democrat, which Cooper would be were he to become a candidate. What else happened last week? Oh, this was a good one. A peer-reviewed study published in the journal Science, Public Health Policy, and Law finds that there are serious safety signals for 37 adverse events following COVID-19 vaccination in pregnant women. Now, remember that big debate when women were being told, it's okay if you're pregnant. The vaccine is safe and effective. Safe and effective. And now this study is contradicting that. And it is mind-blowing what it concludes. An unacceptably high breach of safety signals for 37 adverse events in pregnant women. The study calls for an immediate global moratorium on COVID-19 vaccination during pregnancy. The United States government, medical organizations, hospitals, and pharmaceutical companies have misled and or deceived the public regarding the safety of the COVID-19 vaccination in pregnancy. Some of the adverse effects include miscarriage, chromosomal abnormalities, fetal malformations, I don't think I have to embellish that any further, cervical insufficiency, hemorrhage in pregnancy, that would be the mother, I assume, and on it goes, placental abnormalities, and the one that we would most fear, newborn death. So if you missed that story this week, I suggest that you revisit that because, especially if you happen to be a woman who's pregnant, and the Democrats will also be wanting to sound the warning bell for men who they say are pregnant as well. I'm sure they'll get the memo to them as quickly as possible. some really good news to contrast what I just shared with you. It was a great week to be Mark Fogel. Mark Fogel, you may recall, is a school teacher who was held prisoner in Russia going back to 2021, right around the time that the Biden presidency came into existence after a stolen election. But less than 4 weeks after Donald Trump returned to the White House, Mark Fogel was released. He flew back immediately to Washington, D.C. Many of you may have seen the images of him kissing the ground and then joining President Trump at the White House, where I believe he spent his first night as a guest in one of the honorary bedrooms. A second U.S. citizen was released the next day from a Belarusian prison. Okay, a prison in Belarus. How about that? That sounds better. That American citizen has requested that his identity be withheld for now. That's okay. He's a free man. So Fogel and the unidentified, that follows just since the 4 weeks of the Trump presidency. They come after Keith Siegel, an American Israeli held hostage by Hamas for about 16 months, became one of three male hostages freed at the beginning of February. Back in January, our new Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, announced that American citizen, another citizen held in a Belarusian prison, had been released. And the details around his capture actually have never been quite clear, but he's a free man. Also, at the outset of the Trump administration, six Americans were released from Venezuela. You may recall Trump sent his special envoy, Rick Grenell, down to Venezuela. And by golly, they were home in time for dinner with six hostages released. And I suspect you will see more of that. And, of course, sometime today, we'll be keeping an eye on Gaza and the Middle East as the Trump deadline for the release of all remaining hostages will come and perhaps go, which will not be good news for the Hamas terrorists and their soldiers on the ground, their legions of terrorists who have been holding these hostages and continuing to exploit the aftermath of the brutal October 7, 2023 attacks on Israel, which left 1,200 people dead, including infants and children. A date we will never soon forget, that we can never forget. You may have also missed this week the delicious story that I alluded to earlier. 16 state attorneys general, including the attorney general in neighboring South Carolina. Wouldn't it be nice if we had an attorney general who would, join some of these lawsuits to go after bad people who did bad things? But led by Alan Wilson, the state attorney general in South Carolina, and 15 others, they are they're taking the position that President Biden's last-minute pardon of Anthony Fauci, who was, of course, the White House advisor during the pandemic, and from whom then 45th President Donald Trump received a lot of bad advice, Fauci among others. But these attorneys general are saying, well, you know, the Biden pardon is what it is, but, you know, each of our states, we have the right to pursue legal action against Fauci for the misleading guidance that he provided, which he has now, in some cases, fessed up to. For example, that social distancing, the 6 feet between humans, was totally made up out of the blue. That they really had no idea whether or not masks would be useful. And, of course, the what is now absurd notion that not only should everybody, including healthy young adults, receive the initial COVID-19 jabs by the big pharma makers like Pfizer, but that then they should continue to receive boosters. Remember that when people would come up to you and say, did you get your booster? Did you get your booster? And I'd say, no, I did not. Why don't you remove your mask so I can understand what you're saying? But we'll keep an eye on these attorneys general who are going after Anthony Fauci. I would love to see him parading around in a lovely, form-fitting orange suit. That can't happen soon enough for little Anthony. There was fear and loathing up the road in Durham this past week. You know what happened in Durham? Well, there's a university there. You might have heard of it. It's called Duke University. And they had a career fair, the One Duke All Industry Career Fair. And guess who showed up to do some recruiting? The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement folks, known as ICE. Well, there was a chill in the air when ICE showed up for these students, these snowflakes. A group called Beyond Borders, which is a student organization at Duke, called the arrival of the ICE agents for their recruitment mission a utter contradiction of Duke's values. The same group, Beyond Borders, alleged that ICE racially profiles individuals and detains U.S. citizens and denies individuals' rights to a fair trial. Ridiculous. They arrest criminals, and if they're here illegally, they're starting to send them home at rates we haven't seen, in the last 4 years under the Biden regime. One of the seniors interviewed by the Duke's campus newspaper, I won't name her because I don't want to embarrass the poor child, but she acknowledged that the presence of the ICE agents on the campus was, quote, really scary for a lot of, wait for this, a lot of undocumented students, end quote. Another student, a sophomore, said that the presence of ICE was anxiety-producing and uncomfortable for a lot of the student body. I wonder why. I guess what we were learning from these extremely terrified youngsters is that there may be quite a few illegal, undocumented students attending Duke University. But what we're seeing in the polling in the week since Tom Homan, the border czar, and now newly installed Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, since they've sprung into action, the public is actually responding very favorably to the deportation. We had two plane loads going out of Texas the other day, heading to Venezuela. So that's, I don't know, 200 people, roughly, who are no longer going to be a threat to our innocent American citizens, robbing them, killing them, raping them. They're all back, and many of them have been released from prisons in Venezuela, having been charged with crimes including murder. Well, they're not here anymore. Isn't that nice? I think that's real good. How about moving into our final segment? Mr. Producer, I think it's time to move to the final segment, is it not? Yes, it is. We want to share with you what we're going to be watching in the week ahead. There's plenty to keep an eyeball on. RFK Jr., by now, has been confirmed, barring an unforeseen eruption by some rogue Republicans. Next on the docket will be Kash Patel, sometime maybe next week, who is Trump's appointee to become director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the now weaponized FBI under Christopher Wray and the others who were allowed to operate unchecked during the Biden-Obama regime. The last for 12 of the last 16 years. But there's another interesting development on the horizon, which I just find really exciting to think about. Remember Jeffrey Epstein, the financier, who was also a pedophile and liked to fly around on his private jet, a Boeing 727, commercial sized airliner. And he liked to invite his buddies to go with him to a little Caribbean island for a weekend of frolicking. Unfortunately, a lot of the frolicking was done with underage companions. And everybody is on pins and needles about, of course, Epstein died mysteriously while in prison. That's an important detail not to overlook. Apparently, he managed to hang himself, even though there was no way that he could have done that acting alone. But it is anticipated that coming soon, in addition to Trump's aggressive efforts to release all kinds of files that will provide greater insight into the 1963 assassination of then-President John F. Kennedy, we believe that it is a very strong possibility that the logs and other information related to the life and times of the late Jeffrey Epstein will soon be forthcoming. Play clip one.
The only thing I care about is the scandal of the pedophiles. And in the next 10 days, you're going to see the Epstein file released.
In the next 10 days?
Next 10 days.
Oh, please.
Yep. You think in the next 10 days the whole thing's going to be released?
Yeah.
And what kind of information do you have to be able to be that certain about it?
I plead the fifth.
So that's Glenn Beck as a guest on one of the many podcasts that that I monitor. Well, Glenn Beck's pretty connected, and his Blaze Media organization does a lot of reporting that the mainstream, the lamestream, corrupt media will not, does not, cannot do. So keep an eye on. Can you imagine? I mean, we know that he palled around with Bill Clinton, the former president of the United States, many others in the realm of finance and high tech. So strap on your seatbelt for that one. It's going to be quite a day when that information is released. In the week ahead, of course, we're going to find out, as I mentioned earlier, what in the world is going to become of Hamas and its terrorists as this hostage negotiation hopefully comes to a conclusion and many other innocents are set free. We now have the table set for a potential ongoing diplomatic developments regarding the Ukraine-Russia conflict, now that Donald Trump did what Joe Biden was incapable of doing, which is pick up the telephone and call Vladimir and say, we need to talk. And on one fine Wednesday afternoon, after downing a couple of Diet Cokes and probably a McDonald's Big Mac, Donald Trump had himself a conversation with Vladimir Putin, and looks like there's a possible summit on the horizon between the two of them. And, you know, what we're seeing, and also I believe Trump then followed that up with a call to little Volodymyr Zelensky over in Ukraine, who keeps begging the U.S. to send more money, more weapons, and sometimes he even asks us to send our own young men and women who wear the uniform, which were that ever to happen would be a dark day. And it will not happen now that the Trump administration is in place. I think we can almost take that to the bank. Got a couple more items we'll be watching this week. This came to my attention. An author, I believe he's out of Germany. Certainly he is a European scholar and author and blogger Nicholas Hulsher. He posted a blog that I think we should keep an eye on in the week ahead and perhaps beyond. And here's what he directs our attention to a New York Post report that Vice President J.D. Vance, our new vice president, former senator of Ohio, from Ohio, J.D. has a 12-year-old relative who is being denied, get this, she's 12 years old, being denied a heart transplant because, this goes back to our discussion about Anthony Fauci, because she has not received the cardiotoxic, as the Post describes it, mRNA injection, the COVID injection. She is a 12-year-old Indiana girl related to Vice President J.D. Vance, has been barred from a spot on a heart transplant list at Cincinnati Children's Hospital because she's not vaccinated against COVID and the flu, according to her parents. The young lady is a distant relative of the vice president by marriage through his half-siblings. This young girl was born with two rare heart conditions that her family knew would one day require transplant. By the way, it's worth noting that she not only is a young girl with heart problems, but that her parents adopted her from China when she was 4 years old. So here, these people made this leap of faith to adopt this young girl when she was four, surely knowing or soon finding out that she had a defective heart. In fact, as I said, two rare heart conditions going on at the same time. She's been treated at Cincinnati Children's Hospital for nearly 10 years, but after a decade, the hospital is still taking a hard line, requiring that its patients be COVID vaccinated, and they will not make exceptions even when told that the vaccination, and I hate to use that word, it's a jab using an experimental serum, untrialed and rushed into the market by the pharmaceutical companies who have made billions of dollars. But even when told that they have religious beliefs that prevent them from complying with this jab requirement, they are told by the Cincinnati Children's Hospital, That's too bad. It's a very sad story. And of course, we now have reporting and research that have concluded that there is a growing correlation between the COVID vaccine boosters and prevalence of the actual COVID-19 infection and other pathologies. They can often cause these shots, these mRNAs, which were never intended to treat a virus like this. The creators of it have said so, Dr. Robert Malone, among others. These mRNA vaccine boosters are now being traced to impaired immune system responses in immune-compromised individuals. Well, somebody with two rare heart conditions, if that person isn't immunocompromised, I don't know who is. And yet this gutless hospital in Cincinnati is saying that they will not perform a transplant. I think what we know will happen now, that patriotic American citizens will come forward and figure out a way to find a place where this young lady can receive a transplant. You may recall there was a story very similar in nature that happened right here in North Carolina several years ago with an adopted child as well. And eventually money was raised and a hospital, I believe in Florida, was discovered that would take her in and would perform, I think it was a kidney transplant. Her name was Julia, I think. And I need to follow up on that story because it was a very heart-wrenching situation. I think she was one of 11 children, many of them adopted by their parents. And but I think the young girl that we just described in Cincinnati, let's pray that her outcome is that someone uses common sense and saves her life by giving her the transplant that she needs so desperately. There are a number of bills in the NC legislature that bear keeping an eyeball on in the week ahead and beyond. I won't try to go through the entire litany, but one of them is a measure that will authorize the allocation of $500 million to help victims of the Western North Carolina post-hurricane flooding to continue their recovery. We know right now that the problem necessarily hasn't just been a lack of funding. It's been a lack of commitment by FEMA to do its job. We also know that that void is now being filled in short order by the deployment of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, who are doing in a matter of days what FEMA failed to do over a period of months, and what many volunteers could not do because they did not have the equipment and the manpower to clear literally tens of thousands of cubic yards of debris that have been piling up, that did pile up in the aftermath of the flooding on September 27th of last year, and have been just part of the landscape, sadly, for all these many weeks and months. Keep an eye on Senate Bill 50 in the legislative pipeline up in Raleigh. Many Republicans have been pushing for a constitutional carry law that would allow North Carolinians to have a concealed handgun without a permit. There's a House proposal, House Bill 5, that would allow elected officials in North Carolina to carry a concealed firearm while performing official duties, so long as they have a concealed handgun permit. But what the end game here of this bill is that North Carolina would become the 30th state to legalize constitutional carry. Wouldn't that be nice for those of us who are fans of the Second Amendment? Here's another bill that I really like, and I hope it passes. This applies to our public enemy number one that we were describing earlier, Democrat State Attorney General Jeff Jackson. Six Republicans have introduced Senate Bill 58 that would prevent the Attorney General, sitting Attorney General Jackson and future Attorneys General, from challenging presidential executive orders. In other words, rushing to join other Democrats to sue every time an executive order is issued that they don't like. And all that does is, A, it denies the sitting president his constitutional right to issue these orders, and it ties up in the courts matters that should not be getting in the way of other matters that the courts should be focused on instead. Let me see. There was one other one that I wanted to share with you that's kind of important. Senate Bill 55. A lot of parents and teachers think that we've gone too far in allowing leniency when it comes to children having cell phones in school. Now, there is an argument that is a lifeline in the event of a catastrophe, that being able to communicate parents with their children using cell phones is a good thing. And I agree with that. But there's a bipartisan group of 15 North Carolina senators who think we need to reel that in a little bit. Under this proposed bill, public school students would be prohibited from using, displaying, or having turned on any cell phones, tablets, or computers during instructional time, meaning when they're in the classroom. So doesn't that make all the sense in the world? That kids should not be distracted by their phones, by their tablets, when they're in the class, when they're supposed to be paying attention to the teacher? I think so. The bill also apparently will this is funny. They add in there, they throw in there that the bill would apparently prohibit pagers and two-way radios. So if little Johnny tries to get around the cell phone restriction with his dad's pager that he finds in the junk drawer at home, he'll be called out for that too. Of course, wireless devices under this bill would be allowed if the teacher gives permission to use them. In other words, if they're using the tablet as part of their classroom activities, that would be fair game. So the old clock on the wall tells me how much time we have. We've got 9 minutes. 9 glorious minutes. Well, that's not a problem, ladies and gentlemen. There's been quite a bit of wrist-wringing, I should say, about the exposure of a very long-standing entity which has flown under most of our radars for a very long time. The U.S. Agency for International Development. Now, over the years, it has come to be known as USAID. And average citizens walking around minding their own business have assumed that that acronym infers that it is an organization which provides financial relief, aid to various individuals and organizations and countries around the world who are in need of it. Turns out that's only partially true, and that in fact the U.S. Agency for International Development, which was signed into law by John F. Kennedy back in 1961 in his first year in office, like so many of these organizations, they may begin with pure intentions. They may be founded with clear goals in mind, and over the years they may have actually provided some worthy and much needed aid and funding to legitimate projects and organizations, to legitimate crises, to legitimate areas of impoverished communities, villages, etc. But guess what has happened over these many decades since 1961. The USAID has become a bloated slush fund, which has been used for frivolous funding and nefarious funding. Just to give you a short list of some of the, and by the way, this has been uncovered by the Doge entity empowered by President Trump to, again, find out where we are spending and wasting taxpayer dollars. Some of these that have come to the fore, these are just in recent times. $20 million allocated to produce a version of Sesame Street in Iraq. Let me say that again. Sesame Street, Ernie and Company in Iraq. We don't like Iraq. Why would we want to help educate their kids? Not that Sesame Street is necessarily the best way to do that. $4.5 million to combat disinformation in Kazakhstan. Let that percolate in your brain for a moment. $2 million to underwrite sex changes, meaning for transgender attracted individuals, sex changes in Guatemala, $2.1 million to help the BBC with its diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, the British Broadcasting Corporation. Why can't the BBC pay for its own DEI? $16.8 million to promote inclusiveness and diversity in Vietnam. Good morning, Vietnam, as Robin Williams once said. Here's your $16.8 million. Have a nice day. No questions asked. $1.1 million to support the LGBTQ communities in Armenia. Armenia. And, of course, you'd have to, no surprise, $1.5 million, because, you know, it's lying around. They got $40 billion a year in their little slush fund to launder wherever they would like. $1.5 million to Jamaica. Go to Jamaica, man. $1.5 million to promote gay advocacy in Jamaica. Now, I've been to Montego Bay, and I don't think that there's too much concern about whether or not there's enough gay advocacy. What they need to advocate for in Jamaica is reducing the crime that has all but destroyed its tourism industry. I used to vacation there from time to time, and I wouldn't go near the place now. So USAID, of course, the Democrats are saying, oh, no, you can't cut any money out of USAID. You can't roll back any of the programs that are saving people. Let's see, what was the... They're basically saying that any cuts in these programs will imperil children and leave people starving, stranded and homeless, and so on and so forth, utterly abandoned across the world, across the globe. In fact, in our local newspaper, The Pilot, which is gives a bad name to aviation, especially if you like planes that land after they take off. The Pilot, columnist Steve Bowser, I believe he's the editor emeritus of the newspaper. Newspaper, I'm making air quotes. They published his column the other day in which he lamented the possible demise, or at least the retooling of USAID, because wouldn't you know it, back in the 90s when he was a newspaper editor and the Soviet Union was collapsing in the early 90s, 91, 92, he decided that he was going to commit himself to traveling to Russia and to helping the media outlets there to convert from being Soviet-controlled to become private media entities that could practice actual journalism. Now, keep in mind, in the early 90s, more than 30 years ago, journalism wasn't nearly as on life support and corrupted as it is today. So perhaps Mr. Bowser's intentions were meritorious. I mean, maybe he was doing the right thing. But of course, he needed money to do this, so he became the senior media advisor of the Democratization Office of the USAID. And then after going to Russia and traveling all across the gigantic country, he returned to Washington, D.C., where he continued to be funded by USAID and ended up creating an organization called the Professional Media Program, ProMedia, which morphed into what was called the Center for Foreign Journalists. So he's trying to say that USAID should be a sacred cow because 30 years ago it funded an undertaking that was worthy of time and money. And then that may be true, but the point is that it has become a slush fund being used, as somebody said, to carry out, in some cases, projects that are so dirty that the CIA won't touch them. So they send it over to USAID and let them fund it. That's seriously what it has devolved into. And thank goodness that the Trump administration has shown the light of transparency on it and will move some of this $40 billion back to appropriate uses. Hey, we thank you so much for joining us on Taking Aim. We have been aiming and firing today, and we appreciate you tuning in each and every Saturday morning. We'll be back next week for another edition with my co-host David Hensley. Thanks again, and have a great week.